Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, coming to you Saturday afternoons here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at KMJNow.com. You're going to hear from a couple veterans today with really intriguing stories. They're both prisoners of war. They both live here in Mesa, Arizona. I'm on the road with the Bulldog baseball team, Fresno State baseball coming up at 4 o'clock tonight. And whenever I travel with the Bulldogs, I try to catch up to veterans, proving once again that no matter what your hometown is in this great country of ours, there's probably a hero in that hometown, and you have no idea what he's done to help ensure the freedom that we enjoy. It's Memorial Day weekend. We'll talk about that today as well. Talk about a couple of events happening in our valley, including the city that hopes to be known as the most patriotic in the country. So all that's to come. For now, let's get down to business with a couple of veterans who are spending a hot Saturday morning in the Phoenix area today in front of a Walmart in Mesa, Arizona. They're handing out little plastic daisies with a tag on them that say, American ex-prisoners of war, we exist to help those who cannot help themselves. They hand out these daisies to shoppers at Walmart and then accept donations, which then go to help veterans in need around this Mesa area. These two gentlemen are both in their 80s. They both have incredible stories to tell. So let's get on with that. Time to visit with an 84-year-old veteran of World War II. He was a prisoner of war at the end of the war in Europe. He's originally from Minot, North Dakota, spent a good chunk of his life in Montana, and now retired here to Mesa, Arizona. It's Harry McLean, served with the 86th Infantry Division in Europe during World War II. And nobody that I've talked to ever says, hey, I want to get in the infantry. And that wasn't your plan when you ended up in the service either.
That's for sure. I enlisted in a college program, and they folded the program after I got one quarter of at the University of Kansas, and they stuck us all in the infantry, and we had no recourse. And I'm still upset about that.
Well, I don't blame you, especially after hearing some of what you've gone through. We're going to share that with our audience now. So you end up in the 86th Infantry Division. They send you over to Europe. And did you get there in time for the end of that coldest winter ever, as they like to say?
We got there in time for the middle of it. Yeah, it was. We just about froze to death. They had about 60, 70 of us in the big tent and one little pot-bellied stove with a little pile of coal. And the best you could do is warm your hands and your derriere in the morning, and that's about all you could do.
And your position, you were a scout. Explain for our listeners, if they're not familiar with that, what, as a scout, are you asked to do?
Well, I was the lead scout, the first scout, and you lead the column, and you're supposed to draw the fire. And then they know where it's coming from. So your life expectancy is not as normal as it is usually. But I discovered that a lot of times they'd let the lead scout go by. And that happened enough times to where I'm still here telling you about it.
Well, I'm thankful for that. And I'm sure a few other people are too. I thought you'd say that. Well, let's talk about the events leading up to your capture. And I know there are plenty of intense moments throughout the war, but you're around the Ruhr Pocket at this time, is that right?
No, this was, we were in the Ruhr Pocket, and that was mostly just taking prisoners, but we did get into enough fights up there, we got our company all messed up. But this was in Bavaria, near a town called Landshut, which is on the Isar River, about 80 miles, 85 miles or so northeast of Munich. And there was a big irrigation project there, and that's where they set up a defense. And we were, it looked like a hill from the little town. And we were to hold that and go over there and hold it. And when we got over there, we found it to be entirely different from what we thought it was going to be. And we were just overwhelmed. We, with what we had, with the number of men we had and the equipment and things that we had, we couldn't have taken that thing. It was, they didn't have much left either, but it was a beautiful defensive position.
And I guess we should hit on that, the timing of this. I mean, the war is almost over. Not that anyone knows when the war is going to end, but you're in what, April of 45? Is that about right?
Yeah, it was somewhere around the 5th. somewhere around when Roosevelt died, because that's when you were over there in the infantry, you didn't know what time it was, you didn't know what day it was, you didn't even know what month it was, and you didn't care, you know.
As long as you woke up, it was a good day.
Yeah. As long as you woke up, and we had those delightful K-rations to eat. The only thing in them was cigarettes. Oh, they kept you going, though.
Well, and you mentioned it was about the time that Roosevelt died, and that's how you figured out how long you were actually a prisoner. And how was it that you heard that Roosevelt had died? Was that actually from the Germans who captured you?
From the Germans. There was a young lieutenant who spoke English, and when the captain wasn't around, he was about half friendly. And the captain was around, he was just like the captain. And he told us, and then the captain came out, and he was all irritated over it, and we got a big lecture on what a no-good Roosevelt was, and we listened to that for a while, and then we got worked over a little bit, and that took care of that.
You know, I don't want to gloss over the events of your capture, because this is a pretty intense situation. You're in a firefight. You're ducking for cover at one point, I guess, behind some railroad tracks?
I had a rail for my cover. There was two railroad tracks separated by a deep ditch that carried the irrigation water, and they were over behind the railroad track on their side, and we were over on our side. And I got behind the rail. That's what protected me.
That's where you want to be as skinny as humanly possible, huh?
Yeah, well, and the fact that the ground fell away helped. Helped considerably.
And you're just a 19-year-old kid from North Dakota at this point, half a world away, trying to survive. Tell me about from there to when you were captured. I understand there was quite a while where you were hiding out and didn't know what was going to happen to you.
I was in I rolled down off that hill because I started getting fire from the rear, and I don't think there was anybody else up there. I never did ever run into the other guys that or could find them, the other guys that came off out of that thing that day. I rolled down, got into a ditch. I had to sit about halfway up my body in water. I couldn't get up higher because I put my helmet up one time and pulled it down. They had a big hole in it. So they had us pretty well pinned down. They were watching us pretty close. I sat there for 5 hours trying to figure out what to do. And I had 20 plans, but none of them looked like they were going to work. And it proved out later that they wouldn't have, because I thought we were way out in the country, but we were just real close to a town, and there wasn't any way that I could have gotten out of it. So I just got captured after about 5 hours. Somebody hollered, it was a German, and said, come on in, and I didn't believe him, so I waited a little more, and then one of our guys called, throw your rifle down, put your hands in the air, and come over. So I did, with much trepidation.
Well, I can imagine. I mean, you're all alone on this hill. 5 hours go by, and you're trying to figure out what to do. And I'm sure a lot of those thoughts are telling you, you do this, you're probably going to get killed.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought I'd just... See, I was at the far right, and I thought, well, there's nobody down there. I'll work my way down there. Well, if I'd have done that, I'd have worked my way right in the middle of the lawn chute, so... There was somebody, but they were just around the corner, is how it worked out, I found out later on.
So you get captured by the Germans. Did they tell you what I've heard so often, or is this a myth? Did they tell you the war is over for you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we got that. Yeah, you're all done, you know. And we found out a whole lot about how we should have been joined hands with them and fought the Russians. Our guards hated the Russians. They were in the German army. So we got both sides of it. But our guards, we thought more of than we did any of the rest of them. So, I mean, the guy gives you a pull on a little schnapps at night. You know, you're going to think pretty highly of him in a situation like that, especially.
And those are things to remember. And at this point, you have no idea how long the war is going to go, how long you're going to be a prisoner. Are you going to end up in a camp? Are you going to die along the way? You've got, you know, halfway frozen feet, and they just keep marching you? Do I have that straight?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I did have frozen feet, I found out later. And they gave me some compensation for one of them and not for the other, which is something I could never understand. They were right there together all the time. But they say that, well, that's the way the test came out. So,
how long were you marching, and what were those conditions like? Were you treated well? Were you beaten? Were you tortured? What was that like?
Well, we were beaten early on, and then, you know, actually, when you think about it, they had a lot of problems. They didn't know what they were going to do, and that one guy, I'm sure, wanted to, that captain was a big hotshot, and he wanted to have a career in whatever was left of the German army, and he was making his plans, and we really didn't see much of him after the first 4 or 5 days, which was good because he just kind of a terrifying person.
He would hit you with his big baton?
No, but we figured he was going to take us out somewhere and shoot us, is what we expected to be shot just about every day.
And you had heard of other events like that. The Malmedy Massacre comes to mind?
Yeah, the Malmedy. Now, when you look back on history of the whole thing, that's really about the only thing, was the Malmedy. The Germans were so much more humane than the Japanese were, or the North Vietnam since then. It wasn't any picnic, but we marched, I don't know, we must have gone 30 miles some days. And, you know, we had a lot of 25-mile marches in training, and then you knew you'd been walking, but this was even more so. And then we might have a day that we only went a few miles. And the big thing was food. And we got 3 kinds of food, and they got it from the farmhouses, I'm sure. We got boiled potatoes, we got boiled chicken, and we got some kind of a egg dish that I don't know what it was. It was, it come out looking like a pancake. They were always cold. We never got more than one of them at the same time, and it was probably 2-3 days in between getting them. Now, they let us stop at Crick's and drink, so we got enough water. And we were filthy, dirty, getting lice, tired, miserable, scared, and any other adjectives you can think of.
And eventually, that all came to an end. I don't want to fast forward too far, because I'm very interested in your mindset at the time, having no end in sight, not knowing if you're going to survive this. What kept you going? What got you through those day after day of marching as far as you could march?
You know, I don't know. Just hope, I guess. And when that young lieutenant said, "We're disappearing, you're on your own," I mean, you can't imagine. I can't recall any day that was any bigger than that in my life. I don't want to tell my wife that, because when the day I married her is supposed to be the biggest day. But I mean, that was, and you just, you know, you're not going to have to be worried anymore. Well, we had plenty of worries, but we didn't know it, and as it turned out, why, it worked out okay.
So this is now, you're talking about May of 1945. You've been marching for about a month or more, and the German officer says, "We're leaving, you're on your own." And did he give you any other kind of instructions on how you could get out of there safely?
Yeah, not to go down to the road that we could see. Don't go down there till you know what's on it. So actually, we went back to a farm that we had, the ladies had fed us one time when the guards and the Germans were still there. And we went back there, and those ladies put up with us for about 3 days. And we started getting people drifting in from there. There was a lot of political prisoners on the loose, and we were getting them from all kinds of countries. We had a sergeant that was captured with us that day that could speak Italian, and they had some guys that could understand Italian that could speak something else, and we communicated with everybody in the place and without knowing what in the heck any of them were saying, you know. But that's how we found out who they were and what they were trying to do. And we had quite a bunch when we got out on that road and walked into that little town of Dorfen. They sent us to Reims, France. This was funny. Give us a shower. We got a 3-minute shower, and they took all our clothes off of us and deloused them and deloused us, and then we put the same clothes back on.
I want to get back to this where the lieutenant tells you, you're free to go, we're leaving, but don't go down this road. I mean, he didn't have to tell you that.
He didn't have to tell
that, and that, do you feel like that saved your life? Like some other fate would have waited you there?
I think it sure could have. Yeah, I thought it was a big moment, and I kind of liked that guy anyway. And he always talked to me for some reason. So I thought that was a big thing that he told, that he gave us that tip.
So
I don't know that we'd have thought of that, you know. We were so relieved at not having to worry about somebody lining us up and shooting us.
Well, that was about 65 years ago this month, and obviously those memories are still very clear for you. What was it like for you when you got back to the United States, the land that you're fighting for over there, the country you're trying to keep free? What did it mean to you when you were back on American soil?
It was great. I wish that I don't wish anybody to have something like that, but I wish they got the lesson in freedom and living in the United States that I got. There wouldn't be some of this hooey that's going on right now. I mean, the kids in school they don't know anything about this.
I know that you and other veterans here go around to schools and share some of your experiences with them. Last question for you, Harry, and thank you so much for serving our country and for being willing to talk about what I think everyone can tell is an emotional subject for you, a powerful subject for you. This is Memorial Day weekend. What does that mean to you when you get to this time of year every year and you think about all those guys like you who didn't come home from the war? What does Memorial Day mean in your mind?
Well, it means freedom. And what it took to get it, and what it's going to take to keep it, and I don't think we're doing enough to keep it. I haven't given up, but I mean we should do more to keep our freedom, and I don't like what's going on now.
Well, Harry, I know you're doing your part, and that's why you're out here in front of Walmart and Mesa today, handing out daisies with the POW inscription, "We exist to help those who cannot help themselves." Harry McLean, 84 years old of Mesa, Arizona. And when we come back, another veteran who's out here supporting other vets with the Daisy Project today in Mesa. We'll hear from Dale Shabilsky, an incredible story of how he thought he was going to be liberated, ended up a prisoner at the hand of the Russians during World War II. We'll be right back with that. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, coming to you today from Mesa, Arizona. I'm going to talk now to another World War II veteran who was in the U.S. Army Air Corps, ended up a prisoner of war in Europe. Dale Shabilsky joins me now. And now, anyone that I've talked to that got into the U.S. Army Air Corps did so because of that dream of being a pilot. Is it safe to say that that was your idea, too, when you volunteered at age 17?
That was true. I did want to be a pilot.
And how far down that road did you make it?
We went all the way through advanced training, and we was within 30 days of getting our wings. And General Twining came and delivered our class the message that we were going to be washed out as a result of having more pilots than planes.
So there weren't enough planes for all the pilots. Otherwise, you would have been a P-38 pilot?
That's correct.
Did you ever get to take one of those up in the air in training?
I did. I had three missions in on the state side.
You ended up in another airplane that's legendary, the B-24 Liberator. Those who flew it would swear by it. And some of the guys who flew the other bombers say, well, that was just a flying anvil. What did you think about the B-24?
Well, we were faster and we could carry a heavy load, but we couldn't fly as high. So I got neck problems looking up at the 17s, hoping that they'd stay there and keep the flak coming to them rather than us.
And you weren't a pilot on B-24s. You had a radar and radio position. What were your duties on those missions that you guys took?
Well, on the radar, it was newly invented at that time. In fact, I learned how to operate the machinery overseas in Italy. And the purpose of it was to flatten out the pickup of the ground artillery where they could find us and I could eliminate their blimps of us. one time we used to throw out what was like Christmas tinsel, and it would diffuse the people on the ground. With my radar equipment, I could do the same thing, except we didn't need all the tinsel.
So it wasn't quite as messy that way.
Right.
How many missions did you end up participating in? And you were with the 456th Bomb Group?
Yes. I was, got shot down on my 33rd mission. I had two more to go, and I would have been done.
Well, I was going to say, early in the war, you could get home after 25. Then when a lot of guys got close to 25, they said, nope, 10 more, 35. So you were probably counting down the missions at that point.
That's true. My regular crew had finished, but because I had to take time out to learn the radar, I was behind in the missions with them.
I know there's no such thing as a typical mission because each one was different. But can you give us a sense of what these missions entailed, what kind of targets you were after, and how smooth or not so smooth some of those missions were?
Well, most of the missions were around 10 hours long. We'd mostly go for supply lines, marshaling yards, airports, that type of deal, warehouses. And sometimes we'd go on what was called a terror raid, where we'd drop screamer bombs, and they were effective.
Now, in 33 missions, I imagine that 33rd wasn't the first time you encountered flak or enemy fire. How often did that occur, and did you have some close calls before that final mission?
Yes, one time we had been over Auschwitz in Poland, and we had two engines knocked out, and we got a citation. We made the trip all the way back from Auschwitz in Poland to Italy on two engines without jettisoning anything. As a result of that, we got a recognition for not jettisoning and making the longest mission recorded on B-24 with two engines.
So you must have had a pretty hot shot pilot or some divine intervention or something, huh?
Some of both. We did lose altitude, and we were fortunate that there was a P-51 that tucked itself up underneath our right wing. He flew with us as long as he could, and then he had to peel off because of air fuel. And we made it on. By the time we got to Italy, we was only about 9,000 feet off the ground.
Wow. And I imagine when you did touch those wheels down, there's a pretty big sense of relief or maybe applause throughout the plane or what?
I was shooting flares out of the top of the plane so that the ground crew would be alerted to the fact that we didn't know if our wheels would collapse when we hit or not. But fortunately, everything gave us a smooth landing and none of us were hurt.
Think there are a few prayers said in those moments?
Definitely. I know I did.
I'm not surprised. And when you survive a situation like that, do you say, okay, I've been through that, maybe we can get through anything? Or do you say, wow, that was crazy. One of these days, we're not going to make it back that way.
I never had a negative thought. I was ready to go whenever I needed to go. And I did a lot of praying.
Well, and someone did a lot of answering because you're here talking to me today. That 33rd mission, tell me about that. What were you guys supposed to do that day? What went wrong, and how did you become a prisoner?
The Germans at that time were pulling back. We were out after another marshaling yard in Linz, Austria. Well, when we entered, I could tell that they were throwing everything up that they could. And there's three different kinds of flak, the regular flak, a red flak, and a white flak. Well, white flak is a phosphorus flak. When it hit the airplane sides, it just eats the skin off the airplane. We had two engines knocked out over the target and one after that. You don't fly a B-24 on one engine. So we took a quick boat. We had a boat to either parachute out right then or try to crash land. So we've all voted for crash land because we'd heard too many stories about parachuting.
What kind of stories had you heard?
The people on the ground were beating us with pitchforks and just killing us right there on the way down. Well, we were down to about 5,000 feet, and we just couldn't hold the ground. We ended up in Gwara, Hungary, and I can't tell you how far that is from Linz, Austria, but we crash-landed in Gwara, Hungary.
What was that like? I imagine if you were scared the first time when you're shooting out the flares, this is taking it to another level, right?
That's right. I had been hit over the eye, over my right eye and in my seat our tail gunner got hit in both knees, and he was unable to get out of the turret without help. So, yeah, there was a lot of panic. Our ball turret gunner, he could not bring the ball turret back up, so they had to help pull him up out of there. And needless to say, our intercom system was gone wild. We had to tell people, cool, so you can get messages from the pilot and myself. Part of my responsibilities was to detonate the radar equipment to burn it up. And the bomb site, we had to detonate it, burn it up.
Because you didn't want the Germans seeing what technology you had.
That's right. And also, all the radio equipment had to be detonated and burned up. So that was my job, and it has kept me pretty busy until we hit.
And what was it like when you hit? I can't imagine it was the smoothest landing you had experienced.
No, it was like a hitting up against a brick wall, and it was just a sudden stop. And as soon as we did, we saw all these civilian people coming out, rushing towards us. And your first thought is, goodbye. But they weren't. They were friendly.
Well, it's a good thing they were. So here you are. You're wounded in a couple different spots. You've just hit a brick wall, as you described it, in the crash landing. You think you're going to die, but these folks are actually friendly. What happens to you from there?
We were flying a 13-man crew, and the 11 of them went one way. That none of them were wounded. I learned later on that they had gotten back to the base within 2 days. The tail turret gunner we had to leave behind because both knees were completely shot out. So he was left with the Germans. And later on, I found out that he also did a lot better than I did, that they replaced both of his knees. The Germans replaced both of his knees. He had steak and lamb and all that to eat. I had to go a different way. And to this day, I swear I went to some kind of a church basement. And a man came in, and he took 22 stitches over my eye. He cleaned out as much of the flak out of my seat as he could. And after that, the five men from the local underground said, we need to take you on. We can't keep you here because the Germans are on their way in. So anyhow, we walked from Gwyer, Hungary to Budapest, Hungary. At Budapest, Hungary, I gave myself up to what I thought was our allies, the Russians. As I approached, it was a big pond, and there was these soldiers all around it. And I go in with my hands up saying, Amerikansky, Amerikansky. Well, that didn't register. Underground felt like I should do away with my uniform. So they burned it and gave me civilian clothes to wear. Well, anyhow, when I got there, the only thing I could surmise is that the Russians felt like I was German, because I was in civilian clothes, a blonde, blue-eyed, and I had Army 45, which they took, my dog tags they took, because they just said, well, that, you know, I got them from somebody else. And the only thing I had that was GI was my shorts, undershorts.
So at that point, you're wishing you had your uniform back.
Yeah. They stripped me down to my shorts, tied my hands behind my back, and pointed to a building, which was about 2 football fields away. And it was a cobble field. Well, being barefooted and your hands tied in your back, you don't do too good, especially when they try to run you. And I'd fall down, they'd come along, they'd kick me, and they'd hit me with the butts of their guns. By the time I got to the building, I had 4 teeth broken out, a busted nose, 3 ribs, 5 toes, oh, and the wound over my eye opened again. And I was a mess by the time I got there.
What a nightmare. And you told me you never had a negative thought the entire time. How do you not have a negative thought in that situation? That's horrible.
At that time, all you're thinking is pray. So, and anyhow, we got to the building, and they just made me take a shower. Well, I thought, gee, I've read about this shower, you know, where it's poison to come down on you. Well, it wasn't. It was a real nice, hot, cold shower. And the idea was to wash the blood off of me. Well, all they did is let the water come down. My hands were still tied, so I couldn't do anything more. after they decided I was under the shower long enough, they pulled me out, went to this building and in a room, and they had a stool or a bench. They had me get up on the bench, untied my hands from the back of me, and tied me up on a beam with my hands over my head. But there was two women and three men come in, and they just started talking. I couldn't understand them, and they couldn't understand me. I kept saying, American consulate, American consulate. And anyhow, that didn't work too well. And finally, they brought in a officer, at least that's what I assume, and he could talk broken English. And he had told me that if I didn't tell them the truth and what they wanted to know, that I would not see tomorrow. And he pointed to a woman, and he said, she will get the truth out of you. Well, what they did, they put a bunch of electric electrodes on you. Mm-hmm. And must have been a low current, because when they activated it, my whole body, you just lose control of everything. And they'd leave it on, I'd pass out, they'd wake me up, turn it on again. And I don't know how many times this occurred. But I finally decided I'm going to make up a story. And I said, there's 10,000 airplanes ready to come over to you, and you better be ready. That did not go over good. So I said, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it was 100. That went over all right. Then they were saying something else, this woman, and I couldn't understand her. And so she got real mad at me, and she had a rifle, and she came to the back of me and just really beat me up in my back. Came back in front and stuck the rifle or the barrel of the gun right in my face. Well, I still couldn't understand her. All I could say is American consulate. So it ended up that this man said, okay, we're going to leave you here overnight and let you think about it. And when we come back, you better be ready to tell us. Well, again, I don't know how long, but I know I was there long enough where I no longer had any feeling in my arms. It was just completely, you know, like they were dead. And they had turned out the lights, so it was pure dark in there. And whenever they came back, they showered me with water, woke me up. And again, I couldn't feel anything. And I thought, well, go ahead and kill me. You know, what have I got to lose? And they decided that I was telling them everything I could. Well, when they let me down on the floor, I just collapsed. And they drugged me out of there. And I don't know how. They put me in like what I call a closet, because it wasn't long enough for me to lay down and stretch out, but I could curl up. And they kept me in there. Then they came got me and tried to interrogate me again. Of course, I was too weak to say anything. They take me back, and all I had to in there with me was a bucket. And once a day, I had a tin can full of some kind of liquid and green stuff, once a day. That went on for a period of time. I kept saying American consulate, American consulate. And finally, the war was over. Finally got an audience with American consulate. Well, they interviewed me, and they said, well, it's going to take about a week to 10 days to verify that what you said is true, because they check your family and all that kind of stuff. Well, they did come back, but on the interim time, the one officer said that if I said anything about how I was treated, I wouldn't see tomorrow. And he said, I'll be there when you talk to him. And you say one thing out of line, you're dead. So when they came back, they interviewed me, and they said, yeah, we're going to set you out for free. And this was 30 days at least after I'd been longer than that, about 2.5 months, that all this transpired. And finally I got to, they freed me. The soldier that was there wished me luck. They had a banquet for me. They had a big roast pig on the table, full pig. And they had poured me a goblet full of what I thought was water. I didn't know any better. And man, having not had any water for so long, I bottomed up. Well, I passed out.
Vodka?
Vodka. I truthfully don't know how long I was passed out, but when I woke up, I was back in this little closet room. And I finally woke up, and I knocked on the door until somebody came. And they finally gave me some clothes that I could put on. They were kind of big. Anyhow, we had the banquet again. I don't know if it was the same roast pig or not, but anyhow, there was another roast pig. And this time they poured me this glass, and accidentally on purpose, I hit it and it fell on the floor. Well, I never drank anymore. Because I was a guest of honor, I got the first slice off the pig. Well, it was 100 total fat. Well, I thought to myself, I can't eat that. I haven't had any food for 6 months. So somehow that slipped off on the floor. And I got a piece of ham later and some vegetables. And anyhow, about a week after that banquet, the American people arranged for me to go down to the seaport in Kiev. I got on this English ship, and we went from Kiev over the Black Sea back to Italy. Well, when I got back to the base was deactivated. There was a dentist apprentice and a couple of the base commander and a couple others in one tent. Well, I came down with malaria, and they did the best they could for me then. And the colonel said, well, do you think you'd be ready to fly in about a week? I said, as far as I'm concerned, I'm ready to go now. So anyhow, after about a week, we did fly, and we went back to the States. My folks had been told early that I was missing in action. And then they came and said I was KIA. And they paid him the $10,000. And of course, none of this I knew about. So anyhow, when I got back to the States, I called home. You know, well, my brother answered the phone, and he said, "Who is this?" And I said, "Jack, you dummy, I'm your brother, Dale." And he said, "You're dead. We told you you were dead." That hit me like. He must have got hit by telling I was my. Anyhow, he told me that, well, I better call back in about an hour or so because he had to prepare the folks. My mom was not well. And I said, Jack, I can't. I don't have any money. All I got is clothes on my back, and then we weren't very good. So he said, give me a number, and I'll call you back in about an hour. So that happened. And then I got to talk to my folks. And so this.
Well, I guess it goes without saying that's a day that you'll never forget.
Yeah, very definitely. There's a lot in between that I didn't tell you. If I was to tell you everything, we'd be here a week.
Well, it's incredible what you have shared. And when you look back on all of that and realize how much you survived, how much you came through, how many days could have been your last that weren't, how do you account for that? Why do you think you're still here? And why are you out here today handing out daisies to folks that with the motto that we help those who cannot help themselves?
All I can say is that the good Lord blessed me. And being younger than that, I guess that you can survive some of those things. I didn't think I would. And I am happy to be here.
Well, I'm happy to be here and to have heard your story. Dale, thanks so much for serving our country, for sharing that with us, and for everything you're doing now.
Well, thank you for having me.
All right, that's Dale Shabelsky of Mesa, Arizona. We'll be back with the rest of Hometown Heroes. It's News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. As promised, I'm going to talk about some of the events coming up this weekend in Fresno on Monday. I hope that you'll come out to join me at the Veterans Memorial Museum downtown, the home of the Legion of Valor. The Sounds of Freedom Military Band will be putting on a free concert that afternoon, Monday afternoon at 2 o'clock in honor of Memorial Day. They'll be taking donations for the museum, which you've heard me talk about a time or two on this program. And I'd love to see you there Monday afternoon, 2 o'clock,
at the Veterans Memorial Museum in downtown Fresno, home of the Legion of Valor. Other events going on this weekend. Memorial Day weekend has turned into a pretty big deal over the last few years in Manteca to the north of Fresno. We know we've got a lot of listeners up in that part of our valley. And the guy behind memorialweekend.org, the website, if you want to check it out, and you can find that link at kmjnow.com, is a local pastor from Manteca. He's also a Vietnam veteran. His name is Mike Dillman, and he joins me now to talk a little bit about the events this weekend. Now, today is Saturday, and I guess it all gets started for your Memorial Weekend tonight, right, Mike?
That's correct, yeah. Thanks for having us on. We appreciate the opportunity to share what is happening down here in Manteca. This evening, Saturday evening, we have a Gold Star family dinner, which is a private gathering. We have about 100 Gold Star family members gathering here for that dinner, and then we'll go to the Woodward Park, where we will do a public ceremony opening the tribute that we've built for the weekend, consisting of 5,800 crosses, a recreation of the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, which is absolutely gorgeous, a 100% recreation, and then the traveling tribute, a memorial that I built 2 years ago that has been updated and will be rededicated at Woodward Park at 5:30 this evening. And we sure want to invite anybody that would like to come out and be a part of that to come on.
And I want to make this clear. When you say Woodward Park, you're talking about Woodward Park in Manteca, because there's a famous Woodward Park in Fresno, and I don't want any of our Fresno listeners going out to that Woodward Park looking for you, and you're not there. This is Woodward Park in Manteca. And maybe I got a little ahead of myself here, Mike. Now, I've seen some articles where you said you wanted Manteca to be known as the most patriotic city in the United States of America. So this has kind of been a quest for a while, not just to honor veterans, but to kind of educate the public and make them aware of why they should be honoring veterans too. Do I have that straight?
Absolutely. That is our mission, in a nutshell, to salute all of the veterans who've ever worn honorably the cloth of our nation, to remember the fallen. And there are over 5,800 since 9/11, and then to educate, to make folks aware of the sacred cost of our freedom. And I feel, Paul, like we're actually fighting right now for the soul of this nation, and it's changed. Everything has changed in the last couple of years. Until now, we're really starting to see the foundation of this nation crumble. And if we don't get our citizens on board and begin to understand the way that they can involve themselves in making their vote and their voice heard and make a difference, we're going to lose the republic, God forbid. So that's what we do. That's why we do what we do.
Well, I certainly understand that. And I know you've got 3 days' worth of events here. And tomorrow, Sunday, I guess is kind of the centerpiece of everything you're doing in Manteca, which you hope will be called the most patriotic city in the USA?
Well, I know we have a big assignment to outdo Fresno. I know what Bill Denzel and the guys down there are doing, and you guys have made a huge impact on our nation in the theme of your patriotism. But, yes, we are a city proud of the fact that 19 times a year, we put out 2,400 flags in the city, and we have everybody on board during Memorial Day weekend. We've outgrown our church, and we've taken over the 52-acre Woodward Park here in Manteca. And on Sunday, it begins with an early morning breakfast, a 5K run. I move my church service out to the park. We do an open-air memorial worship service. And then we do a big USO show in the afternoon. We've got Denver and the Mile High Orchestra from Nashville coming. They won the honors of America's Next Top Band last year on the Fox program.
Right.
And they're coming in here from Nashville to do a two-hour USO big band sound and dance. And then we have an official ceremony in the evening. We're busing in, by the way, some of your Fresno people. The World War II Battle of the Bulge guys, mm-hmm. We're sending a bus for them to bring them in here. Earl Watson will be honored.
Earl the Pearl.
Along with some others from your neck of the woods.
And, you know, you talk about Fresno and Manteca, and I don't think there's any rivalry there. I think we can all work together in all the great cities in our valley, and we can just call ourselves Veterans Valley USA. What do you think of that?
I think that's an awesome idea. Awesome idea.
So you have the concert, and then you have a keynote speaker, too, right?
Yeah, event? Derek McGinnis, a young man that got hit in the head with a roadside bomb in Iraq and lost also a leg. And Derek is an amazing young man. He's recovered, literally miraculously recovered. He'll be leading our 5K run. It's an amazing thing to watch this kid on a titanium prosthetic leg lead the pack and actually competes in triathlons. And he's just an inspiration to all of us. The evening ends with a fireworks show. You know, I came home from Vietnam to an ungrateful nation. I had orders in my hand when I got home from Vietnam to take off my uniform because the citizens were so angry with the soldiers and were mistreating the uniform that we were literally told the first thing we should do when we get home is get into our civilian clothes, which we did and which I regret now. But, boy, that was such an uppercut to my heart as a young man coming home after fighting for my nation. I made up my mind that many years ago that on Memorial Day we would find the men and women that have served this nation and never let that happen again. So we put on a big fireworks show to welcome home these men and women of all generations who've come home safely to the embrace of a grateful nation. So it's a big day for us. We spend about $60,000 doing this, and all of the folks in the city helped me do it. Couldn't do it without them. Couldn't do it without folks like yourself. So we just want to invite folks that maybe are traveling north from Fresno or want to make a special trip. Everything's free. We've got three helicopters landing by 10 a.m. We've got a C-17 flyover, which is one of the largest aircraft in our nation's arsenal. We got C-130s flying over. And then we have a parade, an aerial parade. These are privately owned aircraft dating back to World War One up to the current, post-Vietnam. These men own these airplanes, and they've worked them over. They're classics, and they'll fly them over in an aerial parade and show off the aircraft. Post-Vietnam to World War One. That's an amazing thing to see.
Boy, the more you tell me about it, the more I wish I could be there. But this time of year, baseball always has me somewhere. And this time around, it's Arizona. But it just sounds like a tremendous event. And so many thanks to you for putting it on. There are so many places in this valley that do something really special on Memorial Day weekend to honor our veterans past and present. And you're certainly doing a great thing there in Manteca. Is there one thing, Mike, that maybe you've gotten out of this over the years from where you started to where it is now? I know there's been a lot of growth, and I'm sure that's taken you back a little bit and gotten your attention. But is there maybe one experience throughout the whole thing, something somebody said or something you realized that told you in your heart, you know what, this is why we're doing that. This is why we should continue to do things like this.
You know, I would say it's watching grown men weep. I came home from Nam with post-traumatic stress and nearly lost my wife, my ministry, everything that was dear to me because of that post-traumatic stress that the VA said was not treatable. And by golly, I found out that when you engage and find ways to serve and give out of your own need to others, that healing comes. And that's the way healing from my post-traumatic stress came. When I began to look for NAM vets, it started out looking for NAM vets and speaking those magical words. I call them magical words. Welcome home. Thank you for your service. And I'm telling you, those guys melt in your arms. We have we give away hundreds and hundreds of hats. I buy a large number of hats every year that say Not Forgotten. This year it says Not Forgotten 2010. When you put a hat on a NAM vet and you look him in the eyes and say, God bless you, man. Welcome home. You did an outstanding job. They just crumble in your arms. And the strength, the healing that flows back in my direction is just an amazing thing. So that's what we encourage people to do, even if you can't get to Manteca or to a special event this weekend. Find somebody who has honorably served, and thank them. And boy, you're bringing healing to the heart of America's warriors.
Amen. Well, we're running short on time here, Mike. Is there anything else that you'd like to share with our listeners about not only your event, but what you hope they'll be having on their minds this Memorial Day weekend?
Yeah, let me just say that the soil of America's freedom has been watered by the blood of these men, precious, sacred drops of blood. We see these Gold Star families who've given up sons and daughters. They've given up a lifetime of memories, and it breaks our heart. But the opportunity to thank them, those who've given the ultimate sacrifice, is an amazing thing. And I hope and pray that over the Memorial Day weekend, which traditionally is get out the barbecue, get to the lake, whatever else people have on their minds, find somewhere in your community where vets are being honored and where those who've lost their lives are being remembered, and spend a few moments in silence to walk among their names and give God thanks for our country.
Boy, you hit the nail on the head. Those are some great sentiments to be shared, and Mike is not only talking the talk, I know he's walking the walk, and this event in Manteca is proof of that. Pastor Mike Dillman, thank you so much for what you're doing, and I look forward to hearing how it went.
I'll report it back to you, and I look forward to spending some time with you in the near future.
You got it. That's Pastor Mike Dillman from Manteca. You can find more information on that online at kmjnow.com. We're out of time on Hometown Heroes. We'll be back next week. Thanks for listening on News Talk 580 KMJ.